From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Indira Lakshmanan. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, will there be another dump Trump push at the Republican convention? And a political strategist on the overlap between Melania Trump and Michelle Obama's speeches.
That your word is your bond, that you do what you say you're going to do.
That your word is your bond, and you do what you say and keep your promise.
Also today, MIT researchers find more data proving the quantum effects that unsettled Einstein.
And one of the things that really bothered Einstein, and frankly bothers many people to this day, is that in quantum theory, often we say that a particle has no definite properties until they're measured. And that sounds kind of weird. It's like saying that I have no weight until I step on a scale.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and we begin today in Cleveland, where it is day two of the greatest show on earth this week, the Republican National Convention. And it's a big day. The convention will officially nominate Donald Trump for president and Mike Pence for vice president. And the votes from Trump's home state of New York are expected to take him over the top. For more on what's expected at the RNC and what's happened so far, we're joined now by WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, who's at our studio at the convention in Cleveland. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Indira.
So today's theme is Make America Work Again. So what can we expect to hear about jobs and the economy?
Well, we're going to hear a lot about Donald Trump's abilities as a successful businessman and how he can apply that success to building jobs for America. That's going to be the theme of tonight. And here's some of the language from the RNC, just to give you an idea. Quote, the Obama years have delivered anemic economic growth, job-killing regulations, and legislation like Obamacare. These policies are crushing the middle class. So that's a big theme that you're going to hear. No doubt we'll hear a lot more about trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and NAFTA, which Trump says are terrible for American workers. So whereas last night was about national security, law and order, tonight is about economic security and how to help middle-class Americans.
All right. So who are today's main speakers, and do we have any preview of what exactly they'll be saying?
Well, here are some of the big names. Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas. No doubt he'll have a lot to say about Hillary Clinton, the former First Lady of Arkansas. We'll also hear from U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Speaker Paul Ryan, who's the chairman of the convention. And Ryan's speech is going to be really, really interesting. I'm looking forward to this because while he's obviously fervently opposed to the Democrat Hillary Clinton, he's had a tough time navigating support for Donald Trump. So it'll be really interesting to see how he threads that needle.
Yeah, also, tough one. He's really seemed uncomfortable about some of Donald Trump's seemingly racist remarks, and he's not backed those.
Yeah, it's true. And so I think what you're going to hear is really a case against Hillary. And that's sort of been the interesting thing so far, Indira, is there's a lot that we heard yesterday in terms of the case against Hillary. In terms of the case for Donald Trump, we'll see how much Paul Ryan can do that. Also tonight, we're going to hear from Governor Chris Christie, Dr. Ben Carson, and Donald Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr. Those are some of the people we're going to be hearing from.
All right. Well, let's talk about yesterday's open floor revolt. There was an effort by the so-called Never Trump delegates to block his nomination by releasing delegates to vote their conscience. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, there was sort of a mutiny of sorts. So a minority of Never Trump delegates were trying to pass a rule that would have required the chairman of the convention to call the roll, essentially a show of opposition to Donald Trump. Trump supporters would have won the vote easily, but opponents could have slowed the process, gone on record as opposing him. They could have embarrassed him. So among the delegates demanding the roll call were a number of Massachusetts delegates, but in the end, their effort was squashed. So here's Arkansas Representative Steve Womack putting an end to the insurrection.
The question is on adoption of the resolution. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, no. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it, and the resolution. 2.
So, Indira, the effort was defeated, but the delegates in revolt continued to demand a roll call vote. This is a little bit of what it sounded like.
Point of order! Point of order! Point of order!
Okay, wow.
So the, yeah,
it was, that sounds it was, really raucous.
It was raucous. So the anti-Trump efforts, anti-sort of Trumpers lost that effort.
Okay, but Anthony, you were mentioning that some of the Massachusetts delegates were those opposed, part of the Dump Trump movement, and you have one of those delegates with you.
Well, Bob McGinn is the former chair of the Republican Party in Massachusetts. He served in that role from 2011 to 2013. He's a Marco Rubio delegate. He's also a member of the platform committee, and he was there last night, and yesterday. And Bob McGinn, good to have you here on Radio Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Anthony and Indra.
So, tell us your take on what happened yesterday. Should that vote have gone forward? What's your view?
Well, you know, I think because they had a chance the week before on the Rules Committee to simply get 28 of 112 members of the Rules Committee to allow a conscience vote by the delegates, and they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
In some ways you could say it's pretty pathetic that they couldn't even get 28 out of 112. And so with that, you have to say that the outcome was certain. You know, I think actually in kind of a contrarian view, it might have actually helped Trump to have the roll call.
Now, why? Explain that.
Well, because he probably would have, you know, he got 41% of the vote when we, in the primary process, he probably would have got 82% of the vote. And I could just imagine Donald Trump standing up and saying, I doubled my numbers from 41 to 82. This is a united party. So
yeah.
I think he actually could have spun that to his advantage if it had gone forward.
Well, what's your view as a delegate, Bob, though, in terms of this sort of dump Trump, this never Trump movement? I mean, have we seen the end of it? Because, you know, I was talking to one of your fellow delegates from Massachusetts, and he said, look, Donald Trump won fair and square during the primary. As you said, they couldn't even get those 28 votes to change the rule in committee. I mean, isn't this kind of done, and shouldn't people just kind of give up and accept the fact that Donald Trump is going to be the nominee?
You know, I think that it's hard for a lot of people, to swallow Donald Trump, as we know. Out of 17 candidates, the majority of people, as I said, 60% wanted somebody else. But the fact is, he is the one that got the most votes. That's democracy. We don't always like democracy. It's messy and sometimes ends up where we don't want it to be. But that's what we got. And I think people need to just face the facts. One of two people is going to be the president of this country in January, getting sworn in. It's either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And, you know, take your choice.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. McGinn, I want to jump in here and ask you, do you worry that these protests could actually damage the party's chances in November if there is perceived to be, or if there actually is, a divided Republican Party? Could that lead to Hillary Clinton in the White House?
You know, there is indeed that risk. I think that when people who are most likely to vote Republican peel off. So I think it's the peeling off. You know, if people feel like I can go vote for the Libertarians or the Green Party, or I can write in someone else's name, you know, especially in swing states, that could really hurt us. And so I think for Republicans, we do need to come together and just face the fact that, you know, we're running a candidate against Hillary Clinton. This is about, not allowing Hillary Clinton to continue four more years of what's been going on for the last 8 years.
And Bob, let me ask you, as a Marco Rubio supporter, I mean, what you've seen going on here for the last 24 hours or so, I mean, do you sense that this convention is beginning to do what it needs to do, and that is sort of creating party unity around Donald Trump?
Yeah, Anthony, I actually came here last Monday, a week ago, for the platform committee. And that was when I really sensed the ideological base of the party coming together. We wrote, like, if you go around here and ask people, the one thing I think you will find near unanimous agreement on is that we wrote the best platform in, you know, the modern Republican history. And there are things in there that I put in there that most of your listeners would not expect to be in there, like increasing foreign aid to the poor, human rights, combating sexual trafficking, sex trafficking, and things that the Republican Party has always been strong on. But Donald Trump has come on board for this platform. He's really endorsed this platform, and has said to a lot of us that this is one of the ways, Mike Pence being another one, but this is one of the ways that he's trying to pull the Republican Party together.
All right, Mr. McGinn, I want to ask you, last night we heard some really impassioned rhetoric from Rudy Giuliani, who was, of course, a former presidential hopeful 8 years ago. He was mayor of New York during the September 11th attacks. I want to play a clip here of Giuliani, who took last night's Make America Safe Again theme and overlaid the current hot-button issue of race and policing.
We know the risk you're taking. And we say thank you to every police officer and law enforcement agent who's out tonight protecting us, black, white, Latino, of every race, every color, every creed, every sexual orientation. When they come to save your life, they don't ask if you are black or white. They just come to save you.
So, a return to the law and order candidate.
Boy, that was a great speech by Rudy, and I think that, he says what a lot of people in the Republican Party want to hear, and that's that we do not reject people of other faiths, of other gender orientations, of other races or creeds, but we often get painted that way. So that what he was saying, I think, is what so many of us believe.
Well, Anthony, I want to ask you something, because Rudy Giuliani didn't just praise law enforcement. He also attacked Hillary Clinton, saying she couldn't protect America. He used some pretty wild arm gestures and angry facial expressions during this speech, not unlike Mr. Trump does himself at times, for that matter. The theme was Make America Safe, but it felt to some people like he was trying to instill fear. Let's listen to a clip.
In the last 7 months, there have been 5 major Islamic terrorist attacks on us and our allies. We must not be afraid to define our enemy. It is Islamic extremist terrorism.
So, Anthony, yep. What do you make of this?
Well, Indira, I mean, I appreciate the question, this idea of the possibility of instilling fear as opposed to making a case for Donald Trump. And, I'd like to bring Bob McGinn back into this conversation, because this is really a question for the delegates. I mean, it seems like this is a tricky sort of tightrope to walk. I mean, you want to make a case that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have not been able to do the job of keeping America safe, but is it, at what point is there a risk where it looks, sounds like you're sort of exploiting people's fears, I guess?
Yeah.
Did Rudy Giuliani walk that line satisfactorily in your view?
Well, if you think back to the 2004 election, the Republican Party strategy that, fell out of a briefcase in Central Park was we need to make the race about national security.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans win on national security. That's how George W. Bush won against John Kerry. And so I don't think that from a Republican point of view, you can overstate the case on the need for a strong America. That is one of the biggest complaints that Republicans have against Barack Obama, is that he's been too apologetic in the world, leading from behind. And, Hillary Clinton has been too cozy, in my opinion, with the Chinese. She wouldn't stand up for human rights there. And so these challenges that we see in foreign policy, which is the true purview of the president, is, I think, the most important thing. I'm a business person, Yes, the president can help me in my business, but the president will do a lot more with regard to our foreign policy. So,
All right. Well, I'm sure we are going to be hearing a lot more from Hillary Clinton defending her point of view on this 1 week from now. Bob McGinn is the former chair of the Republican Party in Massachusetts and a Marco Rubio delegate. Thank you so much for joining us, Bob.
Thank you, Indra.
Anthony, I want to talk to you now about one of the stranger stories out of the RNC's opening night, which is the controversy over possible plagiarism in the speech given by Donald Trump's wife, Melania. Let's listen.
From a young age, my parents impressed on me the values that you work hard for what you want in life.
So now let's hear another familiar voice from another political spouse.
And Barack and I were raised with so many of the same values. Like, you work hard for what you want in life.
That's Michelle Obama speaking at the 2008 Democratic National Convention.
That your word is your bond, that you do what you say you're going to do.
And here's Melania Trump last night.
That your word is your bond, and you do what you say and keep your promise.
So, Anthony, what has the reaction been there among delegates? And could the accusations of supposed plagiarism hurt the Trump campaign?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, you know, first, we should point out that the Trump campaign on Tuesday denied the allegations that Melania Trump plagiarized Michelle Obama's speech. Here's a little bit of what Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign chairman, said. To think that she would do something like that, knowing how scrutinized her speech was going to be last night, is just really absurd. In terms of the way the delegates are reacting, I mean, obviously, I think they would have preferred, this was the big moment, supposed to be the big moment in yesterday's speech. So, you know, I've got a big TV screen above me. CNN has been sort of running this story all day long. So, yeah, I think Republicans here are obviously disappointed that this has become the story when what they would have preferred was that this is would have been a great story about Donald Trump. I mean, I think the other thing that you hear from some of the delegates is concern that there was a missed opportunity, that while she did a very good job delivering a speech to a big primetime audience, she missed an opportunity to really tell a personal story mm-hmm. that sort of humanized Donald Trump. So I'm hearing that as well. But in terms of, you know, do allegations of plagiarism, is that story going to have legs and sort of carry us all the way through the convention? No. I think this is a 24-hour moment in this convention, and we're going to move on to other speeches. The candidates are going to be nominated, and there'll be a lot more to talk about. That's my view.
All right. That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks in Cleveland. Thank you so much, and we will catch up with you again tomorrow, Anthony.
Look forward to it, Indira.
So for more now, we're joined in our studio by Alex Goldstein, who was a top political advisor to former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. He worked closely on the governor's 2012 speech at the Democratic National Convention. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Alex, you helped write a convention speech, and I imagine that the pressure and the scrutiny in doing that job is intense. So what I'm wondering is, how could a speechwriter have possibly included this mm-hmm. language so close to Michelle Obama's speech? And how could the higher-ups in the Trump campaign miss the similarities with another quite recent convention speech?
Well, you're absolutely right. I remember that time vividly because I wasn't sleeping or eating at all because we were spending so much time perfecting the speech. It was a primetime speech back in 2012. And I actually remember that we had probably about 50 footnotes and citations in that speech that we submitted to the Obama campaign well in advance of the convention to make sure that it was fully vetted. I can't imagine there were fewer than a dozen eyes that looked over that speech. So you're certainly right to raise that question. And I think it's sort of indicative of a broader trend of sort of dishevelment in the Trump campaign apparatus. And I think this is yet another example. I think, you know, to Anthony's point, I don't think that this is a story that's going to linger that long. But both the lead up to how something like this could have happened and also the fallout afterwards and sort of the chaos in the response to it are actually, to me, the bigger story than the actual, you know, incident itself.
Huh, interesting. All right. Well, then let's do our own autopsy here on how this has been handled, since you're calling it a deadly thing. The Trump campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was on CNN's New Day this morning. Chris Cuomo, the anchor, asked him about the similarities in the two speeches. And Cuomo referenced the moment in 2008 when then-Senator Hillary Clinton accused then-Senator Barack Obama of plagiarizing some lines from your boss, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick.
I don't think it's an allegation. It's not some suggestion without proof. I think it happened. I don't know, understand why the campaign doesn't just own it and say people borrow phrases. That's what happened and moved on. That's what, ironically, Obama did in 2008 when Clinton said that he cribbed from Deval Patrick. He said, yeah, you're right. I did it.
No, he did do it. That's correct. But in this particular case,
but,
you know, there was a process certainly of collaboration. And certainly there's no feeling by her on her part that she did it. What she did was use words that are common words. And to expect her to think that she would do something like that, knowing how scrutinized her speech was going to be last night is just really absurd.
Well, I mean, I also find it a bit strange that Manafort is acting as if Melania Trump wrote this speech.
Right.
I mean, clearly a speechwriting team wrote this speech. And so how do you think Manafort handled the situation?
Well, I think it's sort of the classic politics of doubling down. And I don't think he handled it particularly well. If you look at that incident from 08, which I remember quite well, the reason that story moved on very, very quickly was because the president owned up to it immediately. And Governor Patrick came out and said, yeah, we do share ideas from time to time. And that was it. And they moved on. And I think they could have easily sort of killed this a lot quicker had they moved a little bit quicker in that regard. And now what sort of happened is that the sort of irony here is that it's the Trump campaign and various different members, anonymous sources and other leaders within the campaign that are giving this story legs and legs and legs and keeping it going. You've had all these different people throughout the day, including the chairman of the RNC, come out with sort of different recommendations and versions of what likely happened or could have happened and who ought to be fired.
So, well, you know, you remind us that then-Senator Obama acknowledged that Deval Patrick had suggested a couple of lines, and he says, rather, Obama said at the time, I thought they were good lines. I'm sure I should have credited him.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're pointing out, the Trump campaign is not saying, gee, we saw some lines and we thought they were good lines, but how typical is it for advisors and speechwriters to draw from other speeches?
Well, you know, I could say that from my experience and from watching Governor Patrick, he's a guy that writes a lot of this stuff himself, and I'm certain that he calls upon inspiration from other speakers and you know, other speeches he's experienced in the past. But I personally, when I write, it's original content, and I say probably the same for him as well. And if we have any concern, we're going to run that down really, really quickly to make sure we don't end up in a situation like this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was more than just two words, which is what Deval Patrick and Barack Obama agreed on. I mean, there was also the "Yes, we can" line, which Deval Patrick had used and Barack Obama, of course, used. But let's hear one more example of the similarities between Michelle Obama and Melania Trump.
We want our children and all children in this nation to know that the only limit to the height of your achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work hard for them.
Because we want our children in this nation to know that the only limit to your achievements is the strength of your dreams and your willingness to work for them.
All right, so not to blame Melania Trump here, since she was clearly handed a speech to read. But again, I wonder, is this going to have any long-term impact on her and the rest of the campaign? And also, more importantly, is it going to harm Donald Trump's reputation as a supposedly authentic candidate? There was this recent Quinnipiac poll that found that 44% of respondents chose Trump over Hillary Clinton as supposedly more trustworthy and honest.
Well, so I think at this point in the campaign, I've seen so many things that have bewildered me that I'd be crazy to say what's going to hurt anyone at this point. But, you know, having said that, I think the real impact here is actually less the incident itself, but more, I think there's actually issues for both Democrats and Republicans. I think for the Democrats, the concern here is that there was a lot of wild stuff that was said yesterday at the convention. There were things that were xenophobic, that were Islamophobic, that were borderline racist. And you had Steve King from Iowa saying the most unbelievable things on the air around the convention. And all of that has been drowned out. And Democrats have sort of lost the chance to pay attention to some of those issues and bring those to light. And I think on the Republican side, the challenge is that, as was sort of mentioned earlier, this is the ultimate choreographed moment. You get these 4 days and they are this pristine, beautiful thing that you don't want to let go of. And they want them to go perfectly. And you're already 0-1. You've lost day one because all you were talking about is this incident. And I think both sides actually suffer from this distraction because we're not talking about anything I think ultimately the American people really care about. Now, I will say that in terms of credibility, sure, there might be a sort of short-term shot to Trump's credibility. But boy, if you thought he was credible, you know, to this point, I don't think this is enough to make you suddenly believe he isn't. But I think for many of us, we lost that credibility a long, long, long time ago.
All right. Really fascinating. We're going to keep watching this. Alex Goldstein was a top political advisor to former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. He worked with him closely on his 2012 speech at the Democratic National Convention, and he's now vice president at Northwind Strategies in Boston. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me.
And stay with us. There's much more ahead. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. Donald Trump is expected to officially receive the Republican nomination for president tonight. Party officials are planning a roll call vote from each state. Yesterday, a group of delegates tried to change party rules to protest Trump's nomination, but failed. Some critics of Trump have indicated that they might launch some sort of another protest tonight. Massachusetts delegates are bound to vote in proportion to the primary election results, with just over half of the delegate votes going to Donald Trump. We'll hear from a Republican analyst in a moment, but first, we're joined by a Trump supporter and the only woman of color on the Massachusetts Republican State Committee. Rachel Kemp is an investment banker from Dorchester and a Trump supporter. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
So tell me, what were you thinking yesterday as you watched the protest on the convention floor?
Well, I've always told everyone that Republicans have their rules, and Rules Committee met, and they voted in the rules of the committee, and those people were outside of the rules. They were attempting to launch a short-lived protest, and they really had nothing to bring to the table. It would have been one thing if they were able to have a candidate that everyone could have coalesced around, but to say not Trump and to try and break the rules was just not appropriate. And
okay.
they were actually quite wrong.
All right. Well, do you worry, though, that the dump Trump protest might actually damage the party's chances in November?
No. I think that more people are beginning to hear a message that they can actually live with, and particularly if there's the strength in our national security, and also to put in more about economic policy and how they're going to make the lives of average Americans better.
So you see the party uniting around Trump. When the convention ends, you're going to be part of the ground game here in Boston to elect Mr. Trump. So what are you hoping to hear from the convention speakers and from Mr. Trump himself to motivate voters, especially undecideds?
I'm really hoping that they're going to be able to focus in on the economic issues, because that's what Americans are responding to right now. I happen to live in an area where we have one of the lowest per capita incomes in the city of Boston. So when I go out to knock on a door and say, you really should consider the Trump candidacy, I'm going to have to say, because this is the way that he will make your life better. This is the way that he will expand the economy so that there are more jobs and that you will fit into the fabric of the state and of the nation.
So have you heard those concrete proposals for him? Because that's what you need to appeal not only to Democrats who you're trying to win over, but to the 52% of the voters in Massachusetts who are not enrolled in any party, the unenrolled.
Well, and that's absolutely true. That is the message that most of us are waiting for, because
so you haven't heard it yet.
We haven't heard it as of yet. But tonight is supposed to be the focus on economics.
All right.
So hopefully it will happen.
Well, I want to ask you a sort of larger question, which is, what is it like for you to recruit people of color to vote Republican, particularly in your own community, Dorchester, which, as you described, has one of the lowest per capita incomes in the state?
Well, it's very interesting, because on my street alone, I used to be the one and only Republican. Now we have approximately 7 registered Republicans there.
Out of how many households, would you say?
Let's say that we have a good 25 houses on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, going out and recruiting Republicans, it becomes a personal message that you have to deliver. And number two, most people of color find out that they are naturally Republicans. They're conservative with their spending, they're conservative on their social issues, and they actually do believe in the Constitution. And those are part and parcel of the values that Republicans bring to the table every single day.
You were a delegate supporting Mitt Romney at the convention 4 years ago. Former Governor Romney has repeatedly criticized Donald Trump, and he's argued that Donald Trump's election could legitimize racism and misogyny. So as a black woman yourself, how do you respond to that?
Race is a very difficult issue here in the United States, and I think right now it's being used as an excuse for not having the kind of economic expansion that people expected after the post-2008 recession. We still feel as if we're in the recession. So people who thought that they were middle class are now bumping up against people who are absolutely in the lower economic rung, and they're saying, what happened to me? And race is being used as an excuse, and they should open up larger discussions or broader discussions around race, but not as an excuse for something else.
Well, do you personally or do your neighbors have concerns, though, about the sometimes seemingly race-baiting rhetoric that Mr. Trump has used, including when he referred to the federal judge Gonzalo Curiel's Mexican heritage as saying that that supposedly made him unqualified to rule in a case against Trump because of Trump's position on the border with Mexico? Do comments like that worry you?
Well, they worry me because Mr. Trump has no filters. So whatever he's thinking at that particular moment, yes. You just can't, if you're running for the presidency of the United States and to become the leader of the free world, you can't say everything that crosses your mind. However, again, I think that it's opening up that broader discussion and not saying that because you're a judge of Mexican heritage, then you're biased, because it's much like someone saying, well, you're a minority investment banker. No, that doesn't work, because I'm an investment banker first. I take all the same exams and as everyone else. But you, unfortunately, again, the United States sort of colors people with a broad brush.
Well, let me ask you, did you ever support Barack Obama, or have you been a lifelong Republican? I'm wondering whether you were disillusioned, whether race has played any role for you in past elections.
I have been a Republican since the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the day that I registered to vote. It was on the corner of Washington Street and Columbia Road, and the gentleman actually attempted to register me as a Democrat. And I said, no, no, no. I am a Republican because I am an independent person. I'm not asking the government to do anything for me. And that has defined my life. So it was a proud moment when Barack Obama was elected, because that meant, at least to me, that Americans had stepped away from looking at things purely on a racial basis. But I'm a Republican and will always be a Republican.
All right. In the few moments we have left, what will you do if tonight you don't hear the big policy statement about economics and job creation that you're waiting for?
I will actually wait for the Republican and the Trump campaigns to come back to us, the grassroots people, and I will begin to ask the questions and get the answers that I need to legitimately go out there and support his candidacy and knock on those doors to help him to win.
All right. Rachel Kemp is a member of the Massachusetts Republican Committee from Dorchester. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
So many Republican leaders in Massachusetts are also watching the convention closely and from their own homes. Only four of the Republican elected leaders in Massachusetts are in Cleveland, and they're all state representatives. Governor Charlie Baker is at the State House, quote, doing my job. The other state lawmakers are working on passing bills before the session ends in less than 2 weeks. It's a dramatic change from 2012, when Mitt Romney was the nominee and Massachusetts and all of its Republicans were front and center. One of those former delegates and supporters of Mitt Romney was Greg Casey. He's a former aide to Senator Scott Brown and a critic of Donald Trump. Welcome.
Hi, Indira. Thanks for having me.
So I want to ask you, Greg, what has been striking to you as you've been watching the convention, and what do you see as the biggest contrast from 4 years ago when you were a really active member and this time you've sat it out?
Well, the first thing I noticed watching the coverage is every time they would pan on, the camera would pan over to Massachusetts delegation, I noticed how few familiar faces there were. In 2012, there were clearly a seeming appearance of the establishment, as it's become known. And these are folks that I knew and I worked with, and they had been in the trenches for many years and followed politics through Massachusetts in the good, the bad, and the ugly. I don't see those now. I see a lot of people who have just come forward just recently, who haven't been around, haven't been in the trenches. They feel very passionately, and I certainly don't fault them for that. But these are folks who came forward quite possibly because of Donald Trump.
Well, that observation that you're making could cut both ways. On the one hand, it's always good to have new blood in the party. But what you're saying sounds like you're observing kind of a fracturing of the party.
I think that's possible. But I also think there is a lot of hope that these people will be around for the long haul and not just for this one particular moment in time with Donald Trump. And I think that this is something that
That you hope they will support other candidates, other Republicans who aren't Donald Trump.
I absolutely do. And I think we saw a lot of these folks who may have been independents fairly recently, and they voted in the last Republican primary. So we know who they are. We know where they came out in greater force. And I think it's important that we know what their issues are. And it's important that the party does adopt those issues. And so it's kind of strange to be at one time you would have the candidate be a reflection of the party, but sometimes the party has to be a reflection of the candidate. And hopefully Donald Trump will use those issues and ride those to victory.
Well, let's talk about that. You talk about the party being the candidate, the reflection of the candidate, or vice versa. Trump won nearly half of the Republican primary votes in Massachusetts. Something is clearly resonating with Republicans in the state. What do you think it is?
I think what Rachel said was pretty accurate in that his lack of filter is both a negative and a positive in a lot of people's minds. I think people at this point are so sick of the political speak, the people being too rehearsed, too scripted, too concerned about what the special interests have to say and what the media punditry has to say and what the headline is going to be. Donald Trump, whether it's for good or bad, he doesn't care about that. And I think people, even people who are as harsh as critics, at least find that aspect refreshing.
All right. Well, I have to ask you a more difficult question. We may not know the answer for several years, but is Trump's success in the party a sea change in what the base, what the voters want, or is it an aberration in this cycle because he's a popular former reality TV star who's just captured the popular imagination?
Yeah, I from my perspective and from the people that I've spoken to, they're not as interested in Trump as a person as much as Trump who is bringing the message. They don't really care about the reality star, the celebrity. And I think that in the past with Mitt Romney, people really cared more about the individual. They liked him as a guy, and what he had to say almost was a footnote in a lot of regards. It's the other way around, I think, with Donald Trump. His message is resonating, and I think we're seeing a lot of people come out of the woodwork who really never responded much to what the Republican message may have been, but he's saying something that does speak to them, and we can talk about whether it speaks to their fears, whether it speaks to other emotions. But it's quite clear, whatever it is, it's getting them off the sofa, and they are getting out to vote, and they are coming forward. We saw it, and the question is, are they going to continue that into the general election?
Well, that is, of course, the $10 million question, and some people in Massachusetts politics have compared the excitement and the energy around Donald Trump to the excitement and energy around Senator Scott Brown when he won that special election back in 2010. But part of Senator Brown's success was because of voter anger and frustration, particularly around the health care law. The key issues were health care, the economy, the way Washington is working. Doesn't that sound like the same kind of anger and frustration that's driving Donald Trump supporters?
It does. But one thing that I noticed that took place with Senator Brown was that he attracted people, like you said, who had their very different issues. And he was just seen as the opponent to the status quo. And if Donald Trump can bring together an entire coalition of everyone who has whatever grievance they have, whether it be concern on foreign policy, whether it be jobs, whether it be the police unrest or whatever, you as you said, you are getting a lot of people who are angry. And if he can hold those people together, I don't think people are quite as angry in Senator Brown's race as I'm seeing now. This is, it's like that on steroids. And the issues back then were far less emotional as they are now. When you talked about Obamacare, that was a big factor. There were other certain things like, you know, Dodd-Frank was on the horizon and other things. So those were kind of more drier issues. And a lot of just the fact that back then the people thought they were getting it stuck to them. I don't know whether it's the same feeling now.
Well, Scott Brown obviously won your support. Donald Trump has not been able to win your support. So I wonder, do you think that the so-called establishment Republican leaders in Massachusetts, including yourself, will ultimately get behind Trump, or are you all going to sit out this election?
I will absolutely be voting for the Republican nominee. There's no question about that. I never said otherwise. I was a Rubio supporter, and I was a John Kasich supporter as well. I think they are more in line with the way I look at things as a Massachusetts Republican, but I'm also a member of the Republican State Committee, so I will be voting in the Republican for the Republican nominee, that's for sure.
So even though you didn't like him the best, you're still able to live with Donald Trump.
It's happened before, and I know a lot of people who feel the same way about Hillary, who were huge Bernie Sanders supporters, and I think it's actually a little bit more of a struggle for them, quite frankly.
So what are you advising Republicans in the down-ballot races to do, to either appeal to Trump supporters in Massachusetts or to try to be a bit more bland and not take a position, since there's certainly some Republicans or undecideds who Trump has alienated?
The thing that I would tell any other candidates other than federal offices, run on your own issues, your own district. You know your people. You know what they're talking about. I feel badly for any candidate for local office running for state rep or state senate who gets cornered on issues like the TPP or something on trade issues or any federal stuff, because you are going to get people to ask them about that. It's irrelevant, just as the presidential race should be irrelevant. They should run on their own merits and their own issues.
Greg Casey is a former aide to Senator Scott Brown and a former delegate for Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Indira.
Stay with us. We're going to have a lot more coming up, including MIT researchers testing the quantum theory in a new study that might answer some of Einstein's questions. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and you're listening to Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. So let's turn now from the weird world of politics to the even weirder world of quantum mechanics, where physicists for a long time have said that a particle can exist in two seemingly opposite states, for example, spinning clockwise and counterclockwise at the same time. That may defy logic, but now MIT scientists have further proof of quantum theory. And here to explain their discovery are MIT researchers and co-authors of a new study out today, David Kaiser and Joseph Formaggio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello. Thanks so much.
All right, so let's start with the basics. What did you find?
Well, we were studying a particle known as the neutrino, and a neutrino is basically the brother of a more familiar particle known as the electron. They're wispy particles. They tend to go through all kinds of matter without interacting. Fortunately for us scientists, occasionally they interact. And they have some very unusual properties, and they're very manifestly have this quantum weirdness associated with them. And we studied this particular property in a slightly different way, to sort of get at the essence of this quantumness that they possess.
All right, you have my attention. You describe them as having quantum weirdness. What does that mean?
Quantum mechanics has some very strange or spooky features to it, and that don't make sense with our ordinary intuitions for everyday life. And so, for example, these neutrinos or many kinds of little bits of matter seem to be in, they could be in two opposite states at the same time. They could be sort of plus and minus both at once, sort of opposite properties. And so for a long time, for almost 100 years, physicists have known that these equations work incredibly well to describe matter. They make predictions that match experiments beautifully, but they also come with this kind of strange baggage. It looks like, you know, particles could tunnel through walls. It has all these strange properties that don't match our usual intuitions.
Wow. Well, Albert Einstein himself, who helped create the theory of quantum physics, later questioned it and tried to find other explanations for these strange behaviors of subatomic particles. So what do your new findings mean for our understanding of quantum physics?
So it's true that Einstein was a great architect for quantum physics and then really became its most outspoken critic. And one of the things that really bothered Einstein, and frankly bothers many people to this day, is that in quantum theory, often we say that a particle has no definite properties until they're measured. And that sounds kind of weird. It's like saying that I have no weight until I step on a scale. I mean, ordinarily we wouldn't expect that to be the case. And this really rankled Einstein and many, many physicists. So what our latest study was trying to pinpoint is, do these neutrinos, as they're whipping through huge, huge distances, going through solid rock and is traveling nearly at the speed of light, do they make that journey with one particular identity? Are they an identifiable kind of neutrino, or in this sort of mixture state, a kind of ghost-like combination where they're neither type 1 nor type 2 but both at once? Do they move through matter without having a definite identity? And our finding is that really they do.
Well, guys, this reminds me of Schrodinger, the Austrian physicist who devised a thought experiment in which a cat trapped in a box with radioactive material is both alive and dead until you open the box and discover his fate. So what does your study say about this paradox of two simultaneous counterintuitive states of being?
So basically, the predictions from quantum theory are that these neutrinos should each be little miniature Schrodinger cats. They should behave just as you described. Neither either state 1 or state 2, but both and. Both state 1 and state 2 until they're measured. And as Joe was saying, it's actually really hard to measure these things. They go through tons and tons of material without even, you know, pausing for lunch. But a few of them will get captured and get detected. And at those moments, we always get a definite answer. It was type 1 or type 2 or type 3. But in between, do they have a definite identity? If you stop them on the street and say, what are you right now? What would you find? And they're traveling, as our study seems to show, in this mixture state without a definite identity until they're finally detected.
Well, I have to ask, because for the layperson, we often hear about possible parallel universes. Does this study have any implications for our wildest sci-fi imaginings?
We'll leave it to the listeners to continue to imagine those possibilities. As a physicist, we're more interested in the question of whether quantum mechanics specifically is a good description of our world. And so far, it seems that quantum mechanics really applies to many facets of matter, even this exotic matter like neutrinos, that we can't quite escape. Like, oh, this particle is going to act a little differently. And actually, that's not the case. All particles have this this baggage that comes along with quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics is the law of the land.
So we can clock this as a win for quantum mechanics in this 100-year-old debate within physics itself over this theory that Einstein helped create. All right. Well, on this show, we recently discussed another major discovery that came out of MIT, physicists detecting gravitational waves that proved Einstein's general theory of relativity correct. How do your discovery and that earlier discovery together help us understand our universe more?
It's a great point. So this is an exciting time, not just at MIT, but I think for science more broadly. We'll take credit, of course, at MIT. it's exciting locally. But that was, you know, the wonderful discovery of gravitational waves was a kind of fantastic culmination of 100 years of testing Einstein's ideas about space and time. Is space-time a kind of wobbly trampoline, or is it something else? And it really, really is spot on how Einstein described it. Our latest results that Joe and I and our wonderful students were able to put together, in some sense, shows the other side of the coin. So we have relativity and its triumphs, and we also have, we can't get away from, quantum theory. It's strange, but it also keeps working, too. And it's an ongoing challenge for the world's physicists and other people to see if those two pillars, those two building blocks of our understanding, can actually fit together. Right now, relativity and quantum theory are on not exactly a collision course, but they don't quite fit together hand in glove. And yet, neither one's going away. They both fit their own separate experiments really beautifully.
So there could be another three of us in a parallel state who are doing something different than we're doing today? Is that possible?
It definitely is possible, although I don't think we have evidence in favor of it.
Unlikely. All right, you heard it here first. That was David Kaiser, a history of science and physics professor at MIT, and Joe Formaggio, associate professor of physics and head of the Experimental Nuclear and Particle Physics Division at MIT. The two men are co-authors of the quantum mechanics study that will be published in full later this month. And for more on their discovery, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, back here in this dimension, that's all we have for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Virginia Marshall. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. Please join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.